Weighing Machine was created to help you, the financial advisor or investor, reach your long-term financial goals. Each episode, your hosts, Rusty Vanneman and I, Robin Murray, cut through the market glamour to find the time-tested principles that help investors succeed.
The Weighing Machine is inspired by the classic investing saying attributed to Benjamin Graham. The stock market is a voting machine in the short term and a weighing machine over the long run. In other words, emotion and expectations drive short-term market movement, but fundamentals and valuations determine returns over time.
Welcome to the Weighing Machine.
Enjoy, and as always, let us know what you think.
On the podcast today, the economic impact of a COVID resurgence.
We will also discuss inflation, government debt, the role of a client portfolio manager, and the importance of company culture. That's with our guest, Glenn Dorsey, head of client portfolio management at Clark Capital. Welcome to the Weighing Machine. I'm Rusty Vanneman.
And I'm Robin Murray. Okay, let's start with a look at the markets. What are you watching for at the moment?
Well, we're recording this deep in August, and at this point, it looks like we have another positive month in the stock market. But of course, there's a lot going on. And the big topics, of course, are things such as inflation. You know, there's a lot of smart people on both sides of that debate. I'm glad we've got Glenn on today to discuss that as well. Between now and when this is actually published, the Fed will have some statements coming out of Jackson Hole. I'm sure that's going to be interesting in the markets coming up. Earnings season has been phenomenal, by some measures, the best in decades. And so that's good. But of course, the biggest issue of all is COVID and what it's doing. And you can see that kind of in the market internals, where some of the more cyclical stuff, which is assuming the market's going to reopen, is starting to underperform. And we're seeing a lot of stuff about COVID right now.
Right. Well, as you said, the Delta variant is causing numbers to spike all around the country and really around the world. So what do you think, when you're talking about the potential for more lockdowns, if it does come to that, is going to be on the economy and the markets?
Well, I can't be positive short term. I do have a kind of a glass half full spin on it, though. But obviously, we are hearing already, even today, the day of this recording, we're hearing of people already curtailing travel, you know, conferences going virtual again, you know, work from home is going to be extended for some companies. So that's obviously going to have an impact on the economy. I think the twist of it is, of course, you know, we'll get to the end of this at some point. We've said that before, but we will. And I think one of the big concerns in the marketplace has been this whole concept of peak growth, that the second quarter was going to be the strongest quarter for the economy and for corporate earnings. And it still is. But I think the kind of the drop off that we expected to see between maybe the second and third and fourth quarters, we're going to have probably some pent up demand that we're still going to see realized further on down the road. So I hope that's a positive to it, because right now the news doesn't look great.
Well, let's bring in our guest. Glenn Dorsey is Senior Vice President and Head of Client Portfolio Management at Clark Capital in Philadelphia. Glenn, welcome to the Weighing Machine.
Thank you, Robin. And thank you, Rusty. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. So I'm going to hand it off to Rusty to kick us off with the traditional opening question. Rusty, take it away.
All right, Glenn. I gave you advance notice on this, the walk-up song. So the music that we can hear as Glenn Dorsey comes up and starts taking these pitches from us.
I get asked a lot of questions on calls with advisors and clients. I have to say, this is probably one of the most challenging ones.
We usually throw the hardest question first.
Yeah. So I ended up settling on The Only Way I Know by Jason Aldean. Despite the fact that I am a New York resident in Long Island, 30 minutes from Manhattan, I do love country music and a song about working hard, never giving up. And I just like the message in it.
You know, that's great. I think we haven't had a lot of country songs in our walk-up questions that have been answered. And I think it's been these city folks, fancy city folks, that keeps giving them to us too.
We'll diversify our playlist.
That's right. And we do have a playlist now. Again, our analyst, Ben Vasky, created one. So we actually publish it in our weekly blog. So if anybody wants to check out all the walk-up songs, we now have a country song added, another one added to the list.
Well, Glenn, you have been in the investment industry a long time. You've got, I think, more than 30 years of experience as a portfolio manager, client portfolio manager. Tell us more about your background and how you got into investments.
Another good question. For some odd reason, as a kid, I was always fascinated with the market and started tracking stocks and building portfolios just when I was probably 10 or 12 years old. And my parents couldn't figure out what I was doing, but used to sit and go through the business section and try and figure out what a PE ratio was and dividend yields and make different portfolios, and ended up having a double major in accounting and finance in college and knew that I wanted to go the investment route. Started working for an investment consulting firm my junior year of college, and actually sat for my first level for the CFA 2 weeks after I graduated, I think. So got off to an early start and got into the portfolio management side, worked at some of the big name firms that aren't around anymore, like Hearst Trust Company and Mitchell Hutchins, which was the institutional arm of Payne Webber. So a good chunk of my career, I was portfolio manager, focused on high net worth individuals, managed mutual funds, institutional money. And then I migrated into the client portfolio management side, which is sort of more of a higher level view rather than down at the micro level, picking the individual securities, but working with advisors and their end clients to make sure that we have the right blend of strategies in the portfolio. So I started doing that in 2013. I joined Clark Capital Management Group early in 2016 to build out the client portfolio management team. They had sold their TAMP business to AssetMark at the time. And we really realized that what we needed to do, we had good performance and good solid investment strategies, and we had very good distribution, but that client service, the advisor service, they really wanted to build that out. So that's what I was brought on to do, and got 11 folks on my team now, which is great. And from a firm standpoint, we've gone from when I joined, we were about $3.5 billion, and I think we're around $27 billion now. So we've been on a phenomenal growth trajectory in an environment that has not really been conducive to active managers gaining positive flows. And it's been a great challenge and a lot of fun doing it.
Right. Well, walk us through a bit of your day-to-day as head of client portfolio management at Clark Capital. What does your position entail and what do you enjoy most about your job?
So I think of it, you know, I've been dubbed as being bilingual, and that's speaking portfolio manager speak and then end client speak, which is very, very different. What I'm trying to do is translate what is happening in the portfolios to advisors and end clients that may not understand all the industry jargon and terms and Greek letters that often are associated with our profession, and make it make sense. So what that means on a regular basis, one, I'm involved with quarterly review calls for some of our high net worth clients, where we'll talk about what our economic outlook is, what our outlook is for the capital markets, and then review how they've done, what strategies are doing well, what strategies aren't, and making recommendations on tweaks that might happen inside of some of the portfolios. I also do quite a few group calls for groups of advisors. So again, updating them on what our outlook is, what's happening inside of the portfolios, what significant changes are happening, what we see coming down the pike. I really enjoy that aspect of it because I stress to my team is that we really want to put things into common terms. So using analogies for things that make sense to people is really helpful in terms of communicating that. For example, we all know that the stock market can be volatile. And the way we describe it often is it's like turbulence on a otherwise safe plane flight. And you're going to get bounced around a little bit and the captain's going to tell you to put your seatbelt on, but things are going to be okay. And that's what we see often in the market. And I always say that you can tell the difference between an experienced traveler and those that don't when you hit about turbulence. Right, the first time flyer panics and they've got the death grip on the arms of the chair. The frequent flyer, you know, might just be careful about not spilling anything, and the pilot and the flight crew doesn't react. And the same is true in the market. The inexperienced investors panic and get emotional when there's volatility in the market, and the more experienced investors that have been through it more can take advantage of it. And, you know, that's putting things into terms that people can understand. And I think really our end goal is in many ways to be psychologists for our clients, right? To keep them on track with what their long-term game plan is and not to be derailed by a little bumps along the way, because it happens. That's the way, that's what investing comes with the territory. You're going to have volatility, and trying to keep people focused and staying the course is really a big part of what we do. And I really enjoy doing it.
Well, tell us more about Clark. I believe it's a family and employee owned company, right? So tell us about the history there and the mission of Clark.
Yes. Yeah, so our founder is Harry Clark. He was originally an advisor, and he really wanted to basically get into what is essentially the wrap business, if you will, where we're providing the investment services and working with advisors to bring institutional money management to high net worth individuals, where it was typically only associated with institutions, and moving away from that commission based business and going fee based. So he started the firm in 1986, and our mission is partnering with elite financial advisors to deliver investment success. And what I think about it is we're really leveraging the advisor's time. We say that the advisors are primary care physician. They'll take the blood pressure and temperature and treat a lot of things in the office, but oftentimes they need a specialist too. And that's what we're bringing to the table is that, you know, the investment side of the equation, and that's what we're focused on nonstop. You know, we have, I think, 27 people on our investment team that don't do anything other than trying to find the best value in individual securities, whether they're stocks or bonds. And that's a full-time job. Right. So what we're really trying to do is provide that outsourcing capability to the advisors.
All right. So one thing about Clark Capital as well that I've noticed over the years, you guys win a lot of awards, obviously awards for asset management, but there's a couple different awards that are outside of just managing money. And I'd like to ask about those. So one is you won the best place to work by the Philadelphia Business Journal. So one thing I've noticed, of course, is that Clark Capital has been a rock in terms of stability of personnel over the years. How would you define Clark Capital's culture, and how does the firm maintain it?
That is a fantastic question, and it sort of defies odds in some ways that we've grown as much in terms of assets under management as we have, as well as the, you know, the personnel to support it. And we've maintained that culture. We have very, very low turnover. I think part of it is that it is an employee and family owned company. Every employee at the firm owns some stock in Clark Capital Management Group. And, you know, the Clark family's been very good about, I think, realizing that owners work differently than employees do. So there's very much of an owner mentality in our firm, and it shows with the work ethic that people have. And, you know, frankly, from my vantage point, that's the biggest part of the equation, right? It's finding a good personality fit and a work ethic and the mentality of always put the client first and everything else takes care of itself. You know, that's how I was taught when I got in the business in the mid 80s, and that's very much the culture at Clark Capital. So it's a pretty unique place. I've been at bigger firms, I've been at smaller firms, but I've never been at a place where people go out of their way to help each other. And because we always use the term team and teamwork and all this, it's not always apparent when you're at other companies. It is very apparent at Clark Capital.
It's a good point. You know, employee-owned firms, not only do they tend to have happier employees, but just getting down to the brass tacks of investment management, they also tend to have better investment performance over time too. And you're right, it probably just gets into the ownership pride of, you know, crafting the portfolios. All right, getting to the business, another award is Asset Manager of the Year for Distribution Excellence. So in this case, you know, what are the qualities of an investment firm that is strong at distribution excellence? How did you win that award?
The one word I would sum it up with was communication. Again, we talk about partnering and partnership, and, you know, it's basically having a common goal. Our goal is the same as the financial advisors: grow their book of business, keep it, and deliver good results to the clients. So when pandemic hit, the market had a 34% pullback in a month and 4 days. We proactively reached out to our advisor partners and said, what can we do to help you? Can we host a call for your clients so that we can talk this through and make sure that they understand what's happening in the portfolios, why they shouldn't panic? You know, we did thousands of calls with advisors and or their clients to calm people down. So being available, and not only being available, but being proactive and reaching out to the advisors. You know, we did more than 6 times as many market update calls last year as we had done the prior year. And that was really important. Keeping people invested, obviously, as the market came back, delivered the right investment success to their clients, but it also, I think, really solidified our partnership with the advisors that, you know, they came through the other side in good shape. And hopefully a good part of it was our effectively communicating why they should stay the course and what we were doing to help manage the risk in that environment.
Just to fortify one of your earlier points too, I think the role of the client portfolio manager is also huge in those situations. I can't quantitatively prove it, but just in my own personal experience, when an investment firm has those client portfolio managers who can speak to the portfolios, as you said, it enables the investment decision makers to make investment decisions. And yet you can still be very accessible to your clients and to investors. So
yeah, we don't want the people that are pulling the trigger, buying and selling securities, to take time away from their day job and talk about what they're doing, right? We want them to do it and be laser focused on it. I sit in on the portfolio meeting every week, so I'm very in tune with what's going on. I have been in their seat before as a portfolio manager, so I understand what they're doing and hopefully, again, try to communicate it effectively and let them focus on their job.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit here and talk about the economy and the markets today. What is Clark Capital's current economic outlook?
So we distill things down into gauges, basically negative, positive, and the five major drivers of stock prices over time. One of them is the economy. And why? It's because the economy drives earnings and earnings drive stock prices. So what we've seen is what everybody thought couldn't happen, which was the V-shaped economic recovery. We had second quarter GDP coming at 6.5%, which is even better than the first quarter at 6.3%. I think Rusty, you hit the nail on the head when he talked about earnings. You know, at the end of the day, this is another way that we talk to our clients about stock prices. If they're a business owner and their business earns more money next year than this year, you ask them, do you think your business should be worth more? Nobody has any problem whatsoever answering that question. So it's really no different for the stock market. You know, S&P is near all-time highs, and as we're talking about this in the middle of August, and the economy is at an all-time high and earnings that are at an all-time high. Second quarter, year-over-year, S&P 500 operating earnings were up 83% year-over-year. That's on top of 143% in the first quarter. So when we look at things that are forward-looking, housing market is one of those forward indicators that we look at. Typically, the housing market peaks about 22 months before a recession, and we don't see that happening yet. We're getting asked a lot if there's a housing bubble. We don't think so. The average FICO score for home buyers right now is 786, which is way higher than we've seen in what would be considered prior real estate bubbles, where the credit score was down more like 700. All cash deals. So the housing market's important as a ripple effect. One, it speaks to what's the financial shape of the consumer. You can't buy a house unless you are in pretty good financial shape. Banks don't give you a mortgage if you're not. So that's important. It speaks to their sentiment that they feel pretty good. If they're going to take a big ticket item like a house, you're feeling pretty good. And then there's the whole ripple effect of when you spend money. You know, if you buy a new house, chances are you're buying furniture or whatever is going into the house, and that money's then getting spent. So it's that multiplier effect. If you're buying an existing home, you may be doing renovations and you're paying a contractor or subcontractor to do work. They're spending the money. So there's a good reason that housing is a good forward indicator. Yeah, we look at purchasing managers indexes all above 50 showing growth. The obvious one that has lagged behind is unemployment, the labor market. And there's a lot of jobs available right now. I think we're at 10.1 million job openings, 8.7 million people unemployed. It's important to know that unemployment is a lagging indicator. It doesn't tell you where the economy is going. It tells you where the economy has been. Again, if you own a business, you wait till your business picks back up before you hire people. You don't go out and hire a bunch of people and hope that it happens. So there's a good reason it tells you where the economy's been, not where it's going. So when we look at all of that, things still look very solid. Will they continue at the same pace that they have as before, or with earnings being up as much as they are? No. You know, they should settle back down, but there is still a lot of pent-up demand. We've come out of hibernation, and you know, Delta variant obviously is around right now, and that could throw a short-term wrench in things, but people are buying houses, they're buying cars, they're buying all kinds of recreational vehicles, motorcycles, anything that's fun. Retail sales are at an all-time high. So the consumer, which is 70% of the economy, is in good shape. Their debt service as a percentage of income is the lowest it's been in decades. Their savings have gone up. And at the same time, we've spent a record amount of money. So long-winded way of saying economy still looks pretty good.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, and we talked about earlier in the show, the Delta variant is out there upending things a little bit. What do you think is going to be the impact on the economy short-term, long-term from this COVID resurgence?
Well, you know, nobody has a crystal ball on that. Obviously, I always say our crystal ball is more like a snow globe when it comes to exogenous events or things like that that are outside of the economic norm. You know, we saw a spike up in the UK and then it sort of dropped back down pretty quickly too. So we are hoping that this is relatively short term What we have seen and expect to see probably more of is we're back to masks again. Philadelphia, I think you're supposed to wear two masks. I'm not quite sure I fully understand that. But so we're going to see some mask mandates. We'll see some probably localized restrictions come into place, but we don't think we're going to have anything along the same magnitude that we had a year and a half ago. We know a lot more about it. Yeah, remember when this first started out, everybody was wearing gloves and masks and all kinds of stuff. Well, we've learned a lot more about how this works, learned a lot more about how to treat it as well. So I think any impact from it should be relatively short term, we're hoping, and more of like a little headwind than, you know, a hurricane.
So I earlier mentioned that inflation is a really hot topic, and there's really smart people on both sides of the debate. You know, on one side, people think inflation is not just transitory, it's clearly moving higher, it's above average, and it's going to be an issue moving forward. And others, of course, are thinking it is transitory and it will settle back down. What is Clark Capital's thinking on inflation?
So we're going to err on the side of the Federal Reserve. I think they have some pretty smart people there. They think it's transitory. It's consistent with what we're seeing, which is a surge in demand at the same time that the supply chain's not back fully operating yet, right? People have been reluctant to go back to work, whether it's because of enhanced or extended benefits, whether it's childcare because the kids weren't in school. That's all coming to an end, and the supply chain's going to start to catch back up again. So, you know, to us, that's why it's going to be transitory. The supply chain will ultimately start to catch back up with demand again. Now, short-term or transitory for the Fed may be different than what many of our advisors and clients think about. So, you know, this could easily last into the early part of next year. But I mean, ultimately, I think I get asked this literally on every call I'm on right now is inflation. And in my mind or our minds, the biggest threat from inflation is not being invested. It's not your investments. It's not being invested. So if you have money sitting on the sidelines, you're earning nothing on it or essentially nothing at the same time that your costs are going up. Pick whatever inflation measure you want, but 3, 4, 5, maybe higher percent, you're losing purchasing power. So it's important to be invested, have your money working for you. And one of the best ways to offset inflation is to have more money come into your account through interest payments from bonds, through increasing dividends from stocks. Having an increasing cash flow is the best way to offset the effects of inflation. And we've been in a very low inflationary environment for 2 decades. And point is, stocks have done pretty well in that environment. But if you go back prior to that, then in the 1990s, we averaged 3% a year inflation and stocks returned 18% a year, better than we've been in the last 2 decades with a low inflationary environment. And you go back to the 80s, you had 5.5% inflation and stocks return average 17.3% a year. So those were actually 2 really good decades in stock investing. And even if you backed out the inflation, you still had a pretty good real return. So it goes back to my point of you really need to be invested. You need to be actively managing your portfolio. Certain areas of the market or industries or sectors have more pricing power. That's where you want to focus the investments. Certain areas are going to get squeezed by it. It's obviously what you want to try to avoid.
Okay, another hot topic, another question that a lot of advisors are asking, and I'm sure you're getting it too, is government debt. And so how do you think all this government debt is going to impact the economy and the markets?
It's been a fear ever since I've been in the business. I remember the world was coming to an end in the, you know, in the mid-80s because of the Twin Towers of debt. Remember that was the outstanding government debt or the government deficit and our trade imbalance with Japan. Now, neither of those derailed the market. In fact, we went back and looked, the U.S. debt outstanding as a percentage of the economy in 1966 was 40%, and the S&P 500 was at 92. Go fast forward a decade, go to 1976, debt outstanding as a percentage of the economy was 33%. So we made progress on that front, and the S&P was at 91. It didn't do anything, even though the debt went down. Now we're at 147% and the S&P 500 is, you know, over 4,400. So it is an element of what you need to consider, but it is not the only element. And in fact, if you had based your investment decisions around that, you would have missed out on one heck of a stock market rally. Where we have seen it, and I expect that this is going to continue to be the case, is that each economic recovery becomes weaker and weaker. before the pandemic, we were only growing in the low 2%. That was the lowest economic recovery we had had in decades. So, in economic terms, they call it the crowding out effect, that the increase in government debt is siphoning money out of the private sector and soaking up capital. And the reality is the private sector is way more productive. So if that continues to happen, each economic recovery is probably going to be weaker and weaker. And that's something that clearly needs to be addressed. Does it need to be addressed in the portfolios right now? I would say the answer to that is no.
All right. So I have a guess on this. How do these views affect Clark Capital's portfolios? How are you changing positioning right now?
So there's a lot of elements to that. One is that the portfolios are relatively balanced right now between areas that benefit from an economic reopening and those that are more of the beneficiaries of the stay at home. So we're sort of balanced in that approach right now, but we are very much focused on actively managing the bond portfolios, having an allocation to corporate bonds, and in particular, non-investment grade corporate bonds has historically been a pretty good way to do well in the fixed income market, even if rates are going up. You know, we've seen periods of time where, you've had a 100 basis point move up in the yield on the 10-year treasury. And what you've seen is that, treasuries lose money in every one of those environments. Investment grade corporate bonds were positive in two of those 10 environments and generally were down less than treasuries. And high yield bonds or non-investment grade bonds were positive in every single one of those time periods, right? So counterintuitive. So you need to have a thoughtful credit allocation in your fixed income portfolio. On the equity side, focusing on companies that have improving business prospects, which means that they're in a position to not be hurt from an inflationary environment, but also having an increasing stream of dividends in that equity portfolio is really critical. We're up almost about 100% from the lows that we hit back in March of 2000 with the pandemic lows. Earnings have supported that, but we've also gone an extraordinary amount of time without any volatility in the market. Right, we've not had a 5% pullback in over 200 trading days. So as I mentioned with the analogy with the turbulence, would it be surprising if you need to put your seatbelt on a little bit? No, not really. Is it something that we need to make major changes in the portfolio for? No, not really. But it's just kind of a, let's just be aware that all of the flight won't be 100% smooth all the time.
And let's talk more a little about fixed income investing. Can you tell us about your outlook on interest rates and corporate bonds credit spreads looking forward?
So our forecast for the yield on the 10-year treasury has been for this year ranging from 0.75% to 1.75%. So again, that's on the 10-year treasury. We've had a tremendous amount of movement in rates. If you go back a year ago, 10-year treasury bottomed out at 0.54%. We moved up to 1.75%, 1.74%. That's a huge, huge move. And now rates have settled back down a little bit. So kind of what is interesting is that if you think the Federal Reserve is going to make an announcement, possibly at the end of the Jackson Hole Symposium about tapering, it likely will put a lid on longer term rates. And so sort of the opposite of what you think. As the Fed starts to take their foot off the gas pedal, the risk of inflation down the road starts to decrease. And so oftentimes when you have a Fed taking their foot off the gas pedal and then ultimately tapping the brakes by raising Fed funds rate, what will generally happen is longer term yields don't move that much and maybe even go down a little bit while the short maturities start to go up. And then you move towards that dreaded inverted yield curve, which has all kinds of warning signs and bells and whistles for the equity market as well, because we've had an inverted yield curve before every recession that we've had in the US. But we think we have some running room on that. The Fed will likely announce some kind of a tapering program off the $120 billion a month that they're buying now in the open marketplace of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. And they're going to do that before they hit the brakes. You don't go from flooring your car to slamming on your brakes, at least you shouldn't. And the Federal Reserve is not going to do it either. So kind of think we're range bound right now. If Delta variant kicks up, you could actually see longer term rates move down a little bit. And we've seen that. There's also the flight to quality aspect. If equities sell off, treasury yields often come down because people pile into the treasuries for their safety.
Okay, there's one more asset class we haven't talked about yet. Well, if you consider an asset class, and that is, what is your guidance on digital assets, including Bitcoin?
Another very popular question we've been asked, especially when Bitcoin was storming up over 60,000. So we're a very traditional money manager, right? We analyze companies and put a value on it. The way we do that is by forecasting out future cash flows and taking the net present value of those future cash flows. That's the traditional way to value anything. It was an apartment building. You can do the same with a lottery ticket. If you take the upfront payment as the net present value of the future cash flows, and you can certainly do that with companies' earnings. And that's how we do things. The problem with the digital currencies is there's no cash flow, right? So to make money on them, you have to count on another person that's buying it to pay more than you did. The derogatory way to refer to that is the greater fool theory. Now, I'm not saying that you're foolish if you buy that, because art and gold also does not have cash flow, but doesn't mean they haven't been a good investment at times. It does not fit into our traditional way of valuing stocks and bonds. So we're happy to take a pass on it. There's some evidence that there may be more regulation in that space. And I've seen various statistics that suggest that perhaps some unregulated money was one of the things that was driving the digital currency prices up. And if there's regulation on that, that might hurt demand. There's also talk that the US government may try to get involved and have a digital currency as well. So I don't know what that does on a competitive landscape. We're happy to kind of watch it from the sidelines, but doesn't really fit into our traditional stock and bond portfolios.
All right, shifting gears, let's go back towards some more philosophical questions. And one of my favorite questions to ask, and again, I think you are in a great position to answer this, is that obviously you deal with a lot of financial advisors. In your estimation or in your view, what are the qualities that you think make a good financial advisor or financial planner?
I think along the lines of what I said with qualities we look for in employees, it's putting the clients first and then everything else takes care of itself. So that mindset of the advisor always putting the client's interest first is number one above everything else. I think the second is realizing what their core competencies are, what they do the best, and how they best add value to the relationship with the client. In many instances, it is the relationship side of it, and then outsourcing the investment part of it. You know, it's difficult to imagine how a financial advisor can have as much time to spend analyzing investments as, you know, the 27 investment professionals that we have that do it nonstop, right? So I think being that investment coach for the clients, and as I said, sort of being that primary care physician and figuring out what's treatable in the office and what should be outsourced to a specialist is really key to their success and their client's success.
All right. Kind of another twist on another sort of actor, I guess, in the whole, you know, investing ecosystem is when you sit down with the client, the end investor, what are the qualities of a good investor? You kind of know when you have a good client and when maybe you don't. What are the qualities of a good investor?
I think the biggest quality is not being emotional. We sit down and make financial plans when everything is calm and you're rational and you come up with all this game plan. And then you have something like, you know, the pullback that we had last year and people panic. And, you know, we've seen all the Dow bar statistics on why the average investor doesn't do as well as the asset classes. Why? Because they become emotional. So I think taking a longer term focus and not getting pulled into the day-to-day gyrations that we see in prices. And again, the analogy I use, if you start the year and your goal is to get in better shape, and if you eat less and exercise more, at the end of the year, you'll probably see some positive results. But if you jump on the scale five times a day, you're going to get a lot of bad information, and it's going to make you make decisions that may have nothing to do with what your long-term goals are. And that's true in the investment space as well. The more frequently you're hitting the refresh button on your portfolio's valuation, the more likely you are to make a bad decision. So long-term focus, not being emotional.
Good stuff. Well, before we let you go, Glenn, do you have any recommendations for what advisors and investors should be reading or listening to at the moment? If it's books, Twitter feeds, podcasts?
Yeah, we do that a lot internally. We actually have book clubs that our various teams will all read the same book and then talk about what they pulled away from it. So two of the last ones that we did, one was Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. I think for the financial advisors, understanding some of the framework of how people come to their biases is driven home in that book. I think it's a good one. My team right now is reading Setting the Table by Danny Meyer, restaurateur, and it's all about how he built out a restaurant empire and how client service and focus was how he did it. And I think that's very useful as well. terms of podcasts, certainly when I'm driving a lot, the podcasts are great. I listen to Michael Gervais, the Finding Mastery podcast is really good. He has guests on there that are fantastic. And Tim Ferriss show, similar type of thing. I think those are both really good. And I also, you know, encourage people to stuff on their own as well. I spend a lot of time on the St. Louis Fed website where you can get good long-term perspective on things. And I think that makes it a little easier to go through short-term periods when you look at it in terms of a broader long-term time frame.
Well, it's been really great conversation. Great to have you on the show. How can listeners stay in touch and learn more about Clark Capital?
Our website is a pretty good resource for that. So it's ccmg.com, as in clarkcapitalmanagementgroup.com. And then we have a tab up on the upper right, Resource Center, where you can subscribe to a blog. So we can send you all push out all the information that's coming out, but also the things will be posted there. We have video recordings of quarterly economic updates that we have, commentary from the portfolio managers. There's a lot of good information there. So ccmg.com.
Well, Glenn, thanks for coming on the show. I had just one follow-up question, and that was on the book club. Did you say that was just internal among Clark Capital people, or like advisors across the land can join in with you guys?
It's historically been internal, but yeah. Maybe you've planted a seed for something else as well.
You know, hey, we're always trying to build community, right? So what a cool way to do it if you guys are reading the book anyway. So you already have a fan club, and I'm sure it would only make it bigger. Anyway, cool. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Rusty, take us out with your final words.
Stay balanced and stay the course.
We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening to The Weighing Machine, and thank you for your time and trust in Orion Advisor Solutions. The Weighing Machine is hosted by Rusty Vanneman, Chief Investment Strategist at Orion Advisor Solutions, and me, Robin Murray, freelance writer and editor. If you have feedback or questions about our podcast today, please send us a note at rusty@orion.com. All opinions expressed by Rusty Vanneman and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and don't reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion, its affiliate subsidiaries, and its employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.